Picture yourself inside a glass sphere floating in the ocean. Above the shimmering skin of the water's surface is blue sky and air. Below it, a liquid world stretches away beneath you, seemingly without dimension. Now imagine you have begun to sink. As the waves close over the top of the sphere, light and colour suffuse the water. Yet as you descend, that changes. Even in the clearest water, the amount of solar energy declines by almost half in the first metre or so. At 10 metres, less than a sixth remains. At 100 metres, only slightly more than 1%. At first you might not notice this reduction, or only register it as a gradual dimming. The human ability to see across conditions ranging from near darkness to brightest day is only possible because our eyes compress gradations of light. Even if you were only half aware of the drop in the light's intensity, though, you would certainly notice colours beginning to fade as longer wavelengths are absorbed by the water. Reds are the first to disappear, vanishing by about 10 metres below the surface, followed by oranges and then yellows, until finally, at about 200 metres, where the amount of light drops to 1% of what it is at the surface, only greens and blues remain. If you are close to land, it is possible you will have hit the bottom by now. On the continental shelves that fringe the major land masses, the seafloor is seldom more than 200 metres below the surface. Yet given these relatively shallow waters make up less than 10% of the ocean's total area, it is more likely you will continue to sink. Although only the tiniest fraction of the sun's light penetrates below 200 metres, it is not dark here, or not quiet. On a bright day in clear water, it might be closer to a deep dusk. But this boundary, where the layer of the ocean known as the epipelagic, photic, or sunlight zone gives way to the mesopelagic, or twilight zone, is also the boundary beyond which photosynthesis is no longer possible. Above it, in the sunlight zone, seaweed and phytoplankton thrive, converting the sun's rays into energy that is then consumed by other animals. Below it, life relies on energy from above. For many of the animals in the mesopelagic, the solution is to join the DL migration and head upwards to feed in surface waters under the covers of darkness. Others pursue more opportunistic strategies, either feeding on the gentle rain of dead plankton and other detritus known as marine snow that drifts slowly down from above, or preying upon their neighbours. The loss of the life-giving potential of the sun is not the only boundary you cross as you leave behind the light. As you have been descending, the water has been growing slowly cooler. At around 200 metres, the temperature begins to fall rapidly as you enter the transition zone between the sun-warmed waters of the epipelagic and the denser water below. Salinity also changes, especially in warmer regions, where evaporation rates are high, as the salty surface waters give way to less saline water. Look up as you descend, and you will still see the faint glow of the daylight far above. But as you drop deeper into the gloaming of the mesopelagic, the light suffusing the water around you grows ever weaker, until finally, perhaps a kilometre down, it disappears entirely, and you enter the bathyal, or midnight zone. Few mammals descend this far. You might glimpse the shadowy bulk of an elephant seal, whose specially adapted eyes allow it to see in near darkness, or hear the shuddering creak of a sperm whale closing in on a squid. But otherwise, the world of the warm-blooded now lies far overhead. Yet while the sun's rays do not penetrate these waters, that does not mean they are lightless. The organisms that dwell here produce their own illumination, generating dancing flashes and clouds of bioluminescence that spark and glow in the darkness. These displays are sometimes associated with attracting prey. Tiny anglerfish famously dangle a glowing lure in front of themselves in order to tempt unwary prey into the curving teeth that crowd their nightmarish mouths. More often, they are defensive. Many species of copepods, tiny crustaceans a millimetre or so in length, startle predators by flashing brilliantly when threatened, or distract them by producing clouds of light. Other species use bioluminescence as camouflage, producing soft light on their undersides that allows them to disappear into the glow from above when seen from underneath. Still others use it to communicate. Humboldt squid, highly intelligent, fast-moving predators more than a metre in length that hunt in packs of 1,000 or more, use the chromatophores in their skin to produce complex displays of red and white light that travel up and down their bodies. Researchers have identified at least 28 distinct signals and believe the displays are a form of communication, allowing the squid to hunt cooperatively and to interact with potential mates. These signals can be broken down and recombined in multiple patterns to form different messages. Although the scientists who discovered the behaviour emphasise it is too early to say whether the squid are using language as we might understand it. In recent years, it has become apparent bioluminescence is ubiquitous in the deep ocean, occurring in organisms ranging from bacteria up to the mysterious and elusive colossal squid. One researcher I spoke to described bioluminescence flowing over the top of this submersible as they ascended, like a waterfall of light. Others believe it may explain the mysterious flashes and flares of light sailors often report glimpsing far beneath the water, and that Micronesian and Polynesian navigators once used to find their way across the expanse of the Pacific, known as Telapa by the people of the Santa Cruz Islands, and Ula'etahi to burst forth with light in Tonga. It is possible this underwater lightning is caused by bioluminescent plankton reacting to the waves that move along the boundaries between the ocean's layers, or by the movement of large creatures such as whales through clouds of plankton far below the surface. As you descend, the temperature continues to decline until somewhere between 2,000 and 4,000 metres below the surface it tips below 4 degrees, heralding the boundary of the abyssal 4,000 metres down. Cold and lightless, the abyssal takes its name from the Greek word abyssos, meaning unfathomable or bottomless. It is not bottomless, of course. Indeed, it is likely that at some point around here it is possible you might strike the seafloor. That could mean fetching up on one of the mid-ocean ridges that snake their way around the ocean basins like giant sutures. These submarine mountain ranges, which can rise up to 3 kilometres from the surrounding seafloor, form where the tectonic plates are slowly, gradually pulling away from each other, causing molten rock to bubble forth from the Earth's interior. Although often referred to individually, they are really part of a single system, an enormous mountain range more than 65,000 kilometres long that wends its way around the planet's surface. Or perhaps you might fetch up on the side of one of the seamounts that rise from the ocean floor here and there. But it is more likely you will come to rest somewhere upon the abyssal plain, the vast, sparsely populated expanse of ocean floor that stretches from the base of the mid-ocean ridges to the continental shelves and accounts for 70% of the ocean floor and almost half the surface of the entire planet. With only the slow rain of nutrient from far above to sustain it, life moves slowly here. Look closely, however, and you will find fish, octopus, brittle stars, and starfish picking their way across the seafloor, while complex communities of worms, crustaceans, and other invertebrates cling to the few pieces of solid substrate or lurk beneath the largely featureless sediment. Yet while you have travelled many kilometres downwards, there is still further to go. Crisscrossing the ocean floor is a system of trenches. These trenches trace out the fault lines where the tectonic plates collide. As one plate dives under the other, they form subduction zones, essentially giant canyons where the abyssal floor falls away thousands of metres into the darkness. Known as the Hadal Zone, the name refers to Hades, the Greek god of the underworld, and translates roughly as the unseen or abode of the dead. These trenches are among the most extreme environments on the planet. Immense geological forces ripple through these fissures in the Earth's crust, causing earthquakes and sediment slides. And the pressure can be more than 1,000 times that at the surface, the equivalent of a small car pressing on your fingertip, and temperatures a mere degree above zero. As a result, the diversity of life declines as you descend. Hard-shelled creatures disappear by about 5,000 metres. Their chemical processes needed to make their shells no longer possible. And although you might glimpse ghostly snailfish and cusk eels at 8,300 metres or slightly more, even they cannot survive much deeper than that. The cells of Hadal fish are filled with a compound known as trimethylamine oxide, or TMAO, also, incidentally, the chemical responsible for the distinctive and extremely unpleasant smell produced by rotting fish, which helps keep the proteins in their bodies stable. Yet below about 8,500 metres, the concentrations of TMAO required are so high that their cells begin to lose integrity. But despite that, there is life even here. And as you reach the bottom of the deepest trench, almost 11,000 metres below the surface, you'll see pale amphipods and other creatures moving here and there.